called food distribution centers, where, you know, it's kind of like a perverted Squid Games where they're given a certain period of time to get the aid. And if there's any chaos, then, you know, they just start opening fire. And then we see it in our facility, you know, 20, 30 minutes later.
And Doctor, the speaker of the Palestinian National Council, Rawi Fatou, said that he said, quote, never in the history of war have pain and hunger been turned into tools for mass murder, aid used as bait for death, and food distribution centers turned into arenas for mass executions. What are you hearing from these patients who live through this or who are wounded by just trying to get food?
Yeah. Well, you know, they're very aware of the risk. You know, they sit down and, you know, contemplate the risk of going. And, you know, we often will see teenage boys who, you know, want to be heroic for their family and end up going. You know, they are hypervigilant and they are, you know, extremely afraid, and they approach with caution, and they're constantly looking for potential areas to dive under in case shooting starts. So it's this really grotesque, frenetic, you know, situation. And and it's just, you know, it's you know, they're trying to generate fear, which is part of it, but it really is sort of like displacement by death. And I did a little bit of research myself. I'm not an expert in this area, but I don't think this is, you know, this has never been experienced before in modern history that I can tell.
Now, you've worked as a volunteer previously in Haiti and Mozambique and rural Mexico. Yeah. How does Gaza compare?
Well, you know, quite frankly, you know, all of these other situations, I think, you know, right after the earthquake in Haiti, you know, things were pretty chaotic. But, you know, Mozambique was, you know, sort of during their early renaissance and, you know, 6-7 years ago, and things were, you know, really calm and beautiful and growing. So, you know, I haven't been in the military, and, you know, so I knew intellectually that I was going to a war zone, and I knew the risk, and I was, you know, quite frankly, very afraid. And what I've experienced here, you know, I feel relatively safe at Nasser Hospital, but it is just, nothing can prepare you for this. I've seen a lot of trauma in my life, but I haven't seen 50 in a day. I haven't, you know, pronounced 20 dead people in one shift before. There's nothing that can prepare you for this. You know, I was also worried that the intensity of this was going to hurt me, and I was going to have PTSD, and I kind of thought about things that I could do to, you know, attenuate that kind of injury when I get home. But, you know, instead it's been a really uplifting experience meeting, you know, my nurse and physician, allied health colleagues here at the hospital, and, you know, working with them kind of day and night, with, you know, one mass casualty after another, and, you know, working really arm to arm and seeing the resilience and the, you know, the joy and the love that still comes through, and the sense of family and the, you know, forward thinking.
Let me ask you. We might have lost the audio. Dr. Bronner, are you still there?
I am. Thank you.
Oh, if you could comment on the Wafa News Agency reporting another Palestinian child has died of malnutrition. 3-year-old Hassan Barbak died earlier Monday after suffering kidney and liver damage amid soaring blood acid levels due to acute malnutrition. The boy's brother also previously died of hunger. The reports are their family had urgently appealed to transfer the children for treatment, but Israeli authorities denied their request. Can you talk about this issue of hunger, and also UNICEF warning Gaza's facing what amounts to a man-made drought with children at risk of dying of thirst?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really fortunate enough to personally meet, we've been euphemistically calling baby Hassan because, you know, he was really 3 years old, but he weighed less than half of what his normal body weight should be. He had a complicated metabolic disorder, but he really wasn't dying from his complex medical, you know, diseases. He was dying from the policy of not opening the borders and getting getting food in. He died as a direct result of that. And, you know, we actually, my three U.S. colleagues and I, when we met Hassan a few days ago, we looked at each other and we said, we've got to do something about this. It was so compelling. Within 30 minutes, we got the domain name GFC25.org, the Gaza formula countdown, for 48 hours. And we started making a very amateurish but heartfelt, you know, plea to the world to try to get in formula, you know, and, you know, we were not successful. And, you know, baby Hassan died. And, you know, the campaign that we built was, you know, in retrospect, a little bit, you know, amateurish and half-baked. But, you know, there were just four American physicians sitting there with this child and feeling, you know, compelled to do something. And what we did wasn't enough, but we're going to continue to kind of build on this and, you know, to demand the opening the borders to food, specialized formula. You know, so the Freedom Hospital, which is just adjacent to Nasser, they've got 100 children at risk. And these children are at risk day to day because, you know, they never get a month's worth of food in. They get a day or 2 days or 3 days. And so, you know, there's so much stress, unnecessary stress that occurs because of this situation. And we need sustainability. We need to work policy. But this is, you know, this is a much more than a policy level thing. This is, you know, like a humanitarian issue. And we need to, you know, open the borders to food. But as far as the scarcity of water, you know, that is, I believe that, you know, humans can go, you know, months without food, but we can only go 3 days without water. And but I have not personally seen that yet. You know, we see the community streaming in 24/7 with, you know, water containers and vessels to fill their water with potable water and leaving. I'm right now I'm viewing, you know, three or four dozen people walking away with water cans right now. So that is very possible. I believe that reporting. It makes sense to me, but I have not yet personally witnessed that.
Dr. Makbarn, I want to thank you so much for being with us, volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. I think it's so important to point out, as we can hear him so clearly, even though the Israeli government doesn't allow in unembedded international journalists into Gaza, how easy it would be for the networks to broadcast the voices of people in Gaza right now. We're going to turn now from what's happening in Gaza and the question many are asking, if Israel and Iran can achieve a ceasefire, why not Israel a ceasefire in Gaza? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Speaking at the NATO summit, President Trump has defended the U.S. strikes on three Iranian nuclear sites, claiming the attack set back Iran's nuclear program by decades. Trump made the comment a day after a number of news outlets reported a classified Defense Intelligence Agency assessment found the strikes likely set back Iran's program by a few months. Meanwhile, Trump's praised other NATO nations for agreeing to drastically ramp up military spending to 5% of GDP within a decade. Spain, however, pushed back, saying the goal was unreasonable. Trump spoke earlier today.
I've been asking them to go up to 5% for a number of years, and they're going up to 5%. That's a big, from 2%. And a lot of people didn't even pay the 2%. So I think it's going to be very big news. NATO is going to become very strong with us.
To talk more about Iran, the NATO summit, We're joined by Richard Seymour, writer, broadcaster, activist based in London. His latest book, titled Disaster Nationalism, The Downfall of Liberal Civilization. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Richard. It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to what has so far transpired at the NATO summit?
Well, it seems that they've reached an agreement to raise military spending to 5%. That was controversial. You mentioned earlier in your broadcast the protests in Slovenia, but there are a number of European states that really don't want to spend that much money. Spain, for example. In the UK, they have talked about increasing military spending to 5% of GDP. At the same time, that they're cutting welfare by £7 billion and creating a massive political crisis for the government. So it seems there's a real guns and butter dynamic going on here. It'd be interesting to figure out why Donald Trump has insisted so much on this. In the past, when Americans have wanted Europeans to spend more on defense, it's been so that America could range further abroad. And concentrate its efforts outside of the European theater. That doesn't seem to be the logic here with Trump.
But Richard Seymour, I wanted to ask you, the Peterson Institute recently put out a report saying that the United States itself only spends about currently 2.9% of its GDP on military spending. And over the last 50 years, it's only averaged about 4.2% of GDP. So Trump is pushing Europeans to spend a greater percentage on the military than even the United States, the military power of the world, is doing. Who benefits from this other than the weapons manufacturers?
Well, it seems that the European elites are very much in favor of it. This is one thing that Mark Rutte, head of NATO, was very keen to praise Donald Trump for in his very Trumpian missive, talking about how Europe would pay. It would pay bigly, not exactly his words, and it would be a great victory for Trump. Actually, it seems that part of what's going on here, the logic of it, is that they can achieve through militarization a certain kind of industrial policy, an expenditure aimed at modernizing their economies that they weren't able to achieve by other means. For example, Germany, in the last few years, has made an effort to overturn a clause in the Constitution which says, you know, you can't incur debt as a state. And they wanted to do that in order to invest in the climate transition. The courts struck it down. But now they can spend 100 billion euro on military investment. So this is military Keynesianism. And I think that that's a big part of the appeal for governments across Europe, where essentially the project of some form of left social democracy has hit the buffers, has been thwarted in many instances. Modernization of the economy by other means is a part of it. But I also think a part of this is political consensus and political management. A number of reports have been coming out in recent years talking about how European states need to prepare themselves for war on the unlikely prospectus that there would be a direct confrontation with Russia, and that this feeds into a general sort of counter-subversive thrust, talking about hybrid warfare, about informational politics, placating the domestic terrain. In the UK recently, the counter-terrorism advisor, Jonathan Hall, argued that such matters as what he called gender ideology, you know, trans rights, that sort of thing, could in fact be evidence of Russian subversion, and that therefore the UK could need counter-subversion laws. So there's a logic on the one hand of domestic political economy, and on the other hand of domestic political management. And I think that's as much to do with this as any putative geopolitical stakes with Russia.
We just have 30 seconds, but President Trump, the first term, was going after NATO, saying they wouldn't support Article 5, the U.S. coming to the defense of another NATO nation. But now playing around with that and saying only if they hit 5% military spending might the U.S. support them. 20 seconds, Richard Seymour.
Yeah, briefly, I think the U.S. is abandoning hegemony. Hegemony meaning, you know, universal values, multilateral systems that everybody's supposed to benefit from. Trump wants to move towards a much, much more instrumental and crudely material transactional politics. So I think this is a version of imperial decline that Trump is trying to manage.
Richard Seymour, we want to have you back on to talk about your book, Disaster Nationalism, The Downfall of Liberal Civilization. Thanks so much for joining us from London. When we come back, a dad of three Marines, two active duty and one Marine veteran, is brutally beaten by Border Patrol. We'll speak with his son. Stay with us. In our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the immigration crackdown. ICE detentions have reached all-time highs, surpassing 56,000 people. The largest increase are people arrested with no serious criminal history. Nearly a third of ICE detainees have only immigration violations on their record, up from just 6% in January. This is according to data analyst Andrew Kocher. We turn now to just one case out of Southern California. On Saturday, Narciso Barranco was arrested while working as a landscaper at an IHOP in Santa Ana. We are watching federal agents. The video taken shows seven federal agents, all masked, pinning 48-year-old Narciso Barranco to the ground, repeatedly punching him in the head before pushing him into an unmarked vehicle. Barranco was born in Mexico, has been in the United States for more than 30 years. He also has three sons in the U.S. military, two active-duty Marines. One who joins us now is a Marine veteran. Alejandro Barranco was able to see his dad in custody yesterday, days after the arrest, still wearing the same bloodied clothes. We're also joined by Jonathan Hernandez, a council member for the city of Santa Ana, California. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Alejandro. The country is seeing this horrific video of your dad being beaten, punched in the head by these masked agents. Explain what you understand happened and how he was yesterday when you saw him.
So yesterday when I saw him, he looked beat up. He looked rough. He looked defeated. He was sad. It's just not right the way all this is happening. I think anybody would be scared if they see these guys come up to them masked, not in uniform, guns out. It was bad.
And did your father tell you what they said to him, or as they came up, was this part of a general sweep, or were they specifically just targeting him?
I think it was just a general sweep. There was reports that they were in the area where he was at, and I think they just saw him racially profiled and came up to him. They had no warrant for him. They weren't looking for him. My dad has no criminal history.
Now, you served a tour in Afghanistan. Can you talk about the rules of engagement that you had in place when you were there? And should federal agents be held to a similar or higher standard than soldiers in war zones?
Yeah, for sure. I do believe that there has to be a proper rules of engagement. I don't even know if they've made that public yet. And over there, I mean, You couldn't really do much. You can't hit back. You can't shoot. You can't do nothing unless someone were to shoot at you or directly try to harm you.
After the video of Barranco's arrest went viral, the Department of Homeland Security responded to a local news report with a post on X saying, quote, he assaulted federal law enforcement with a weed whacker. Perhaps the mainstream media would like our officers to stand there and be mowed down instead of defending themselves. What a completely slanted portrayal of what actually happened, unquote, the government said. Your response?
My dad didn't try to attack them at all. In that video, it shows them pepper spraying him right before he turns. And I think it's just a natural instinct and body movement to try to defend them. Try to defend himself.
I want to bring Jonathan Hernandez into this conversation. You're a city council member with the Santa Ana City Council. You shared the viral video showing Narciso Barranco being punched by the Border Patrol agents. Can you talk about your first reaction when you saw this landscaper being taken down by masked men? And my question is this. Why are city councils around the country passing laws that say protesters can no longer wear masks? But why not pass laws that say agents can no longer wear masks? I remember in New York when a police officer would cover just their badge number with black tape. If you could prove that, there would be trouble. And now we're talking about masked and hooded agents. Jonathan Hernandez.
Yes, thank you. Well, first and foremost, I want to begin by sending a message of solidarity with the family of Narciso Barranco, and I want to applaud his son Alejandro Barranco and thank him for his service to our country. They are a shining example of what Mexican-American families represent and our devotion and love for this country. What we have seen over the course of this past weekend on video is injustice. We are seeing a extreme abuse of power on the screens of our phones, and we have seen a hardworking Santa Ana resident of over three decades who has raised three children who have all decided to sacrifice their freedom for this country that we love. Their father was treated as if he's not birthed American heroes in our country. And what we are seeing across the nation is a community and a country that is growing united in that we are watching the violence unfold. We are seeing racial profiling increase in cities like Santa Ana, where 41% of our residents are migrants, 70% are of Latino descent. The majority of those in the Latino community in Santa Ana are of Mexican descent, families like the Barranco family, families like mine that migrated here from Mexico to Santa Ana. We have examples of you know, for one, over $100 million of taxpayer money here in Orange County is accredited to immigrant families, families like Mr. Barranco. And what we are seeing is unidentified agents come into our community, and they're refusing to identify themselves. They don't have judicial warrants, and these ICE raids are an example of the government's overreach, and they're a violation of our First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights. And Mr. Barranco is a clear example of Donald Trump's administration targeting some of the hardest working American families that we have in Santa Ana. And in this community, we're going to stand up to ensure that, number one, Narciso Barranco is brought home to the city of Santa Ana so that he can be reunited with his family. Number two, that the National Guard and the militarized, approach to policing in our community ends immediately. There is no reason for people to be beat on camera because they are immigrants. And lastly, we want for every single agent who comes into this community to identify themselves. And as a policymaker, I will be making sure that the department understands that that is a top priority to our city.
And council member, you said in the past that a day without Mexicans is a day without America. How are you seeing these workplace raids and these sweeps in cities like yours undermine the economic fabric of local communities?
Well, that's a fantastic question. The brutal reality is, you know, the violence that we see firsthand on the screens of our phone isn't just tearing apart our families and our backyard. It's also tearing apart our local economy. Our economy in Santa Ana is upheld by immigrant, hardworking families like the Barranco family. And when you look in Santa Ana, you know, what helped us carry through the COVID pandemic were these very immigrant workers that Donald Trump is now targeting. These were the essential workers that were keeping groceries on your table. These were the essential workers that were providing healthcare access to your family. These were the essential workers that continued to keep your kids educated. These were the essential workers who made sure that you had a place to eat. And in Santa Ana, what we're seeing is, you know, the impact economically is deserted businesses, city streets in the downtown that are not flooded with our residents walking and spending their dollars after school and with their families. This has had adverse impacts on our local economy. It's affecting our local businesses and it's affecting our residents. You have people who are choosing to not go to work. You have children who are choosing to not come out of their homes. And lastly, you know, part of why I mentioned a day without Mexicans is a day without America is because this city of Santa Ana is proud of its deep Mexican roots. And a day without us is a day without Santa Ana. I say this as somebody whose family migrated from San Juan de los Lagos to the city of Santa Ana in the 1950s. My grandfather, much like the Barranco family, we gained citizenship by fighting in America's wars. That is how we were able to bring over family members. And I think what is important for us to remind this country is, although we may sacrifice all of our freedoms to fight for you, we ask in return that you treat our family as Americans as well, because we are proud to live here. We are proud to fight for this country, and we're proud to start our families in these cities. And that's why we, in the city of Santa Ana, understand how important families like the Barranco family are to this beautiful community, because it wouldn't be Santa Ana without families like the Barranco family.
Well, I'd like to bring in Alejandro Barranco again, a Marine veteran and the son of Narciso Barranco. What's your reaction when you hear your father, who's been here working for more than 30 years, is referred to by the spokeswoman for Department of Homeland Security, Tricia McLaughlin, as just an illegal alien?
I think it's inhumane, and I think they're acting in ways that are just not professional. I encourage these types of people to look more into our community, to visit our people, talk to our people. They're hardworking people. They love this country, and they love to give back.
Alejandro, your active duty Marine brothers, two of them, are stationed at Camp Pendleton, while 700 of their fellow Marines were deployed to L.A. amidst the immigration protests. And, of course, you're a Marine veteran. Your final thoughts on what's happening today? And do you know if your father will get out?
I'm not sure my father will get out yet. That's what we're trying to push and trying to do. And then about the whole Marine Corps thing in LA, I mean, I know these Marines are just following orders. But I do believe that they're hurt as well. As I know that a lot of their families are undocumented or came from another country and raised them right. And that's why they're there.
Alejandro Barranco, we thank you so much for being with us. Marine veteran, son of Narciso Barranco, who's currently being detained in California. And Jonathan Hernandez, council member for the city of Santa Ana. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, ich bin Arndt Peltner von Radio Goethe. Ihr hört Mike mit Noise of Carpet right here on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca. Hello, this is Arndt Peltner, host of Radio Goethe. You're listening to Mike and his Noise of Carpet, celebrating the indie noises of the 90s on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.
Do you like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.